Support comes from Empower Missouri's Affordable Housing Coalition, working to address the causes of housing insecurity and homelessness through tenant advocacy. Information at empowermissouri.org/housing.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking. Juliana Stratton has had a meteoric rise throughout Illinois politics. And now the state's lieutenant governor is hoping to succeed longtime Democratic U.S. Senator Dick Durbin in one of the most competitive primaries in the nation. Stratton joins us next on Politically Speaking to talk about the big issues and why she's different than the two other major candidates in the race. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, an in-depth examination of Missouri and Illinois politics.
The instant we got to Illinois, we joined the Green Party. This was 2000.
So I've tried to push for those that I think are honest and really care about the future of the city.
You know, this wasn't a path that I thought I would choose in 2012 when I was able to win the closest Republican victory in the nation.
If it's something that will help Southern Illinois, I'll work with them on it. If there's something he's doing wrong, then you got to fight him on it.
I believe very strongly in the Second Amendment. I believe less government is better, and I believe local control is better.
I choose to fight for working families and for union members.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio political correspondent Jason Rosenbaum. Joining me today is our guest host. He covers all things Metro East for St. Louis Public Radio.
Will Bauer.
And the lieutenant governor of the great state of Illinois. I think you're not originally from Illinois.
I'm not.
So we actually outnumber you today. Our guest today is?
Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton.
Thank you for joining us today. You're one of three major candidates in the Democratic primary who is running to succeed Dick Durbin. Before we ask you about your campaign and some of the issues, just tell us a little bit about yourself. You haven't been in Illinois politics for an eternity, since 2016, I think.
Yes.
But you've had a pretty quick rise throughout this I was going to say crazy political system, but it's not as crazy as Missouri, in my opinion. But continue.
Well, you know, this story really did start for me 10 years ago. I was, I'm a mom. I was working full time, but I was also caring for my mother. I always say it's a story that many people can relate to, that many call the sandwich generation. But I've picked up the term the panini generation because...
Okay.
You know, sandwiches sound kind of gentle and nice, but paninis you squeeze together and you add heat. And that's what it felt like, being a caregiver and juggling, you know, all of those other things. And at the time, my state representative was working to strip away health care from seniors like my mother. He was a 13-year incumbent. And I got angry at that and I stepped up to run against him. And I won. And I lost my mother the day before I launched that campaign, but it was a reminder that government can and should be a force for good. I ran for state representative, won, served in the Illinois House. 6 months later is when then just J.B. Pritzker asked me to be his running mate, and the rest is history. We've served together now for 7 years, and here we are 10 years later, and I once again see a real need, and I'm stepping up to meet that need, running for the United States Senate.
You're a Chicago resident, but I believe you live on the South Side, correct?
Born and raised on the South Side, still live on the South Side.
Okay, and reason I ask, Chicago Cubs or White Sox?
I support Sox, Cubs, and Cardinals, I should say, but I am a true White Sox fan, to be honest.
Okay. Well, it's better than the Cubs for our listeners.
2005.
Down in St. Louis,
yeah. just for the record, the 2005 team is the most dominant World Series champion of any baseball team in the history of the world.
That's right.
And my wife is from the Southwest Side and is for some reason a Cubs fan.
It's a criminal.
That 2016 team was pathetic by comparison. But let's continue.
Well, I live not too far from the stadium, and I just will say, just for the sake of listeners, I am in a house that's sometimes divided, and I'll leave it at that.
Okay.
Contentious. Just like this primary, maybe.
Boom.
Yeah, why did you decide to run for U.S. Senate? When I saw that you decided to do that, my first impulse was you're giving up a likely chance to be the first black female governor of Illinois to do this. Why did you decide to do this?
Because look at what's happening in Washington right now. It was an urgent moment. I felt that 10 years ago, like I just told the story about caring for my mother and saying, no, I'm not going to sit on the sidelines. I don't shy away from a fight. And everything is at stake right now. You know, it's not just healthcare any longer, although that is at stake. Our rights, our democracy, our communities. Look at what's happening in so many of our communities. And I'm a mom of four, and my youngest, so I have three adult daughters and then a little one. And she woke up the day after the election last year, and she was in tears when she heard the outcome. So I'm fighting for her. I'm fighting for all of our children, everyone who deserves a better world. And I know that I can bring the kind of leadership that's needed to meet this moment.
Emerson College polling released at the start of January has you in second place. Krishnamoorthy leads the pack at 31%. Robin Kelly sits at 8%, but 46% are still undecided. So I'm wondering, how do you at this point stand out in a crowded pack?
Well, I stand out in several different ways. First of all, the fact that when I travel the state of Illinois and talk to voters directly, and I am getting everywhere, what they are telling me more than anything else is I'm looking for someone who will go to the mat fighting for me. That they have a real clear sense that Washington has become sort of this culture of go along to get along. They don't see the kind of energy that's needed to meet this moment, that they want fighters and not folders. And, you know, it's a real distinction. I don't, you know, as the only person in this race that has represented the entire state of Illinois for the last 7 years, I don't come to this race to just talk about what should happen, although I have lots of big ideas and bold ideas. I talk about what we've done. I mean, Governor Pritzker and I have really turned things around for the state of Illinois from where we were before with a governor that really was driving us to a state of bankruptcy. And I'm proud of that. I'm proud of how we've protected workers' rights, how we've protected reproductive freedom, how we've created thousands of jobs and passed 7 consecutive balanced budgets, how we have created an economy that works for working people. These are things that we have done directly, and that's an example of the kind of leadership of getting things done that I'm going to bring to Washington.
So, okay, with the context that there have been Democratic governors in recent history that did not get a lot of things done, like Pat Quinn and Rod Blagojevich, I could see the counterargument from some of your opponents saying, well, of course it's easy to do all those things when you have a supermajority Democratic legislature and you don't have, for instance, a governor like Rod Blagojevich, who is a megalomaniac narcissist. What would you say to that?
Well, I talk about my record, first of all, as a legislator. Before I was lieutenant governor, I was a state representative. So I've served in the legislature. While I was a state legislator and a state representative, I got 10 bills that I was the chief sponsor of passed and signed into law. All 10 of those bills were passed on a bipartisan basis, many of them passed unanimously. And it's because I understood the real need to build relationships and educate about the bills and gain support. So I know how to do that. And that those bills were signed into law, by the way, by a Republican governor, I just want to emphasize. Yes. So my background, I am an attorney, but for 20 years of my career, I had an alternative dispute resolution practice, so I did mediation. My job was to bring people from differing perspectives and on the other side, you know, like sitting on the opposite side of each other, to the table, try to understand what's important to them, and come up with a win-win solution. So that is a skill that has served me well, and it's certainly one that I will take to Washington.
And it seems to me that you've been trying to maybe carve a lane out for yourself in this primary from the left, and we can talk more about the policy later. I'm thinking no corporate PAC donations, $25 minimum wage, for example. But I'm curious, how would you define yourself and your politics?
Well, my campaign is really focused on giving the people what they want. That's what I talk about. And I don't use it as sort of because there's a label. The way that I came to that was because I am talking to people and I'm listening to the people of Illinois. And what the people of Illinois are telling me is, I want higher wages. Everything is too expensive right now. And we have a president who said that he was going to come in and on day one he was going to lower inflation. He was going to lower the price of groceries and cost of everything was going to go down. He has not only not done that, he lied about that, but he's made things worse. And everybody is feeling it right now. I mean, we are seeing it in our own family, how different decisions have to be made because of how everything is so expensive. I hear people tell me, I want access to healthcare. No matter where I live, I want to be able to get to a doctor when I need one, which is why I support Medicare for All. And no corporate PAC money is as simple as this. People see Washington as being this place where the red carpet is rolled out for corporate special interests while everyday people get left behind. People don't want that. So it's not about a label or, you know, where do I see myself on any particular spectrum? What I see this as is who's going to fight for the people? And I'm glad that I can look at people, look them in the eye and say, it will be me.
Now, of course, many of your opponents have said the PAC that supported you has dark money, right, from undisclosed sources. And your boss, J.B. Pritzker, made his money from the Hyatt Hotel chain, and he's donated to that PAC $5 million in December. And I imagine there's some in the Democratic primary voter bloc that may appreciate you not taking corporate PAC money, but on the other hand, you're supported by a billionaire who made money via a corporation. So how, if at all, do you reconcile those two things?
Well, first, let me point out that any opponent who calls it dark money when it's actually been reported, the sources that have donated to that PAC, which I can't coordinate with, so I don't have anything to do with that PAC, but it's not dark money because it's all been reported. So it's not true when my opponents have said that. So I just want to point that out. Look, I'm not accepting any corporate PAC money in this race. I've been endorsed by In Citizens United because of my stance on not accepting corporate PAC money and the work that I am going to continue to do to bring about real campaign finance reform. I don't think that money should be the central way that we see elections decided. And yet I have an opponent who has spent the last 10 years raising money, doing nothing but raising money, not really getting anything done for the people, but raising money so that he could run for this seat.
You're talking about
Congressman Krishnamoorthy.
Yeah. And one of the criticisms, I think, I don't know if it was you or maybe some of his other opponents, but he took like $90,000 from, I guess, contractors that have been aligned with Donald Trump or something like that. I guess the cynical point in me is if you've raised $24 million, like, are you really influenced by $90,000 over a 10-year period? Like, what do you make of that argument?
Well, first of all, let's talk about some of the sources that have been reported. MAGA contractors, ICE contractors, mm-hmm. MAGA advisors have donated to him, including some of the architects of Project 2025. Those corporations that are supporting the president's golden ballroom. And when Congressman Krishnamoorthy was first asked about these donations, especially from the CTO of Palantir, who is one of the contractors that's helping ICE to terrorize so many of our communities, he said, I'm willing to take money from anybody who supports my mission. And it wasn't until outside groups started calling for him to return that money that he then donated it to immigrant rights organizations, he says. So this is an example of values. He's taken millions of dollars in corporate PAC money, and some of the donations, as we just talked about, are from people that if you say that I am going to be someone who stands up to Donald Trump, if I'm someone who says we need to stand up against ICE and the terror in our communities, then accepting money from those sources does not line up or align with those values. I'm not accepting corporate PAC money because I'm going to stand up for the people of Illinois, and those are the values that I have.
One more question on money and politics. Congressional stock trading, should it be allowed?
No, I will, as a member of Congress, I will, fight that as well.
I do want to ask you about something that your potential predecessor did, and that was vote to keep the government open and not have any guarantees about the tax credits with the Affordable Care Act. Would you have voted in a different way than Senator Durbin on that point?
Yes.
Can you explain why?
that was a moment when I believed that Democrats should have held the line and held firm. You know, we know that. So in addition to being a mediator, I've taught negotiation skills across the country. And I've done that for a number of years. And when it comes to negotiations, you can't really negotiate with someone who comes to the negotiating table in bad faith. And the Republicans and Trump and his administration consistently come to the table in bad faith, saying that, well, we'll give you a vote. We knew that they weren't going to allow that vote to either take place. And if they did, they weren't going to vote for people to have health care. And I believe that we should have held the line and not given away the leverage that we had to fight for people to have health care. I have a daughter who, as I might have said earlier, has her insurance under the ACA exchange. Mm-hmm. And she called me as we kind of switched years from 2025 to 2026 to say, look at what I have now as my premium. And I'm going to have to change my plan to the lowest plan, the one with the least amount of benefits, to make it more affordable. Millions of Americans had to make a decision of whether or not they were going to continue to have health care. And we know that this is happening at the same time that rural hospitals are on the chopping block, that Medicaid is being stripped away. So we have to fight for people to have health care. That's a non-negotiable for me. And we need to make demands and say, unless these demands are met, you're not going to get one vote from me to advance your authoritarian agenda.
And along those same lines, or the theme of fighting, not folding, I think there's a lot of many younger, more progressive Democrats that believe minority leaders Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries have not led the party the way they should. So if you're elected to the Senate, would you back Chuck Schumer as the Senate minority leader?
I would not.
Who would be the person that you would like to see take that role over?
I mean, I think, first of all, this is a time that we need, as I've said before, real leadership, courageous leadership. And we're not seeing that energy met, to me, in leadership in the Senate. I should also note that I'm the only candidate, leading candidate in this race, that has made that commitment. My opponents have not done so. And I don't think that that's what Illinois voters are looking for people to, again, just keep the status quo going. I don't know who might throw their hat in the ring. I will listen to all of them. But I can absolutely tell you that it should not be Chuck Schumer.
We need to take a quick break. But when we come back, we'll return to our conversation with Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton. And we're back on Politically Speaking with Illinois Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton. She is one of three major Democratic candidates running to succeed U.S. Senator Dick Durbin. We have a lot of issues we want to talk about, and I'm going to give you first pick of what you want to ask the potential future senator.
Well, I think affordability and the economy seem to be, if not the most pressing issue, one of the most pressing issues of the midterms, and maybe the most eye-popping of your proposals. You were talking about it a little bit earlier, $25 minimum wage. Now, we did speak with Robin Kelly a little earlier, actually last week, and she was saying, I don't find it to be realistic. I don't think we can get Congress on board for $25 at the minimum wage at the federal level. What would your response be?
My response is that we have to give people not just a minimum wage. We need to give people a livable wage. And that's what I will be fighting for. $25 an hour is a livable wage. $17 an hour is not. And I don't think people are looking for people to say, well, this is not realistic. I'm not sure if we can get that done. That's not the fight people are looking for right now. People want bold ideas. People are struggling right now in the grocery store. They're struggling to put food on the table. And let's remember, it is $7.25 at the federal level. That's the minimum wage right now.
Hasn't changed since 2009.
Hasn't changed since 2009. And we raised the minimum wage to $15 an hour here in Illinois, which I'm very proud of. And it took some time to get there. But guess what? $15 an hour is $31,200 a year. Cut that in half at $7.25 or so. And you're talking about people who are working two and three jobs just to make ends meet. Why are we still operating there when we have the ultra rich getting wealthier and wealthier under this administration? So this is a time that we have to be realistic about where people are and what they need to take care of themselves and their families, maybe have a little extra money in their pockets, maybe be able to save a little and spend a little more in our local economy, at our small businesses. $17 an hour, great. That should happen tomorrow, not something that can take, you know, some years to get there. We need to start thinking big and get people to a place where they have what they need.
You've also proposed Medicare for All. Why is that necessary, and how would you propose the federal government pay for such a venture?
Well, I'd support the bill that's already been filed, Medicare for All. I talked about how my entree into this sort of elected office was really from caring for my mother and what happens when government says, hey, we're going to take away health care from you. It's not right in this country that we have people making choices. It's not right that people making choices of between paying their bills and getting health care, or people sitting, you know, they broke their ankle and they're sitting in a hallway of a hospital for hours because there aren't enough professionals, or they just don't have the right access to health care that they need to be seen and be prioritized. That's not a system that works for people. In fact, I always say it's not a health care system, it's a sick care system. And we need to make sure people have the care that they need. This is an issue of health equity. When I think about rural communities that, not, you know, as I mentioned, 9 hospitals on the chopping block potentially, people driving hours. I led in the birth equity initiative here in Illinois to address the maternal mortality crisis, and there's just not enough. So we need to do more to get people the care they need. Everyone should have access. Healthcare is a right, not a privilege. And it shouldn't depend on the job you have or the zip code that you live in to be the determining factor of whether you can see a doctor when you need one.
And then just procedurally speaking, I'm imagining a challenge to maybe either the $25 minimum wage or Medicare for All will be the Senate filibuster. What do you think about the Senate filibuster? Is it time for it to go, or do you think it's got a good place in crafting legislation?
Well, the filibuster has been a part of blocking a lot of progressive, you know, legislation that can really help people, whether it's voting rights or reproductive freedom or, you know, common sense gun legislation. So I think we need to abolish the filibuster, or at least seriously reform the filibuster. All of those things I mentioned, whether it's protecting voting rights or reproductive freedom or common sense gun legislation, we've done that here in Illinois. We've been able to get that done, but that's been blocked at the federal level because of the filibuster. And when Senate, you know, the Democrats take back the Senate, I want to see us abolish the filibuster and at least seriously reform it so that we can get some of those big things done.
I wanted to ask about housing, which has been another proposal that you've talked about, housing reforms and whatnot. And I wanted to ask about a executive order that Trump signed that bans Wall Street investors from buying single-family homes. I'm just curious. Is that something that you can actually get on board with?
Well, here's what we know, that there's not enough housing, not enough affordable housing. We need to build more. And one of the reasons why there's not enough affordable housing is because we do have too many corporations that are buying up housing stock. And then everyday Illinoisans, middle-class families can't compete with Wall Street. I can even tell you my own personal story. You know, having 4 daughters gives me a lot of things that I'm thinking about as a leader about why we need to make changes. But I have one daughter, a couple of daughters actually, who are wondering, am I ever going to be able to afford to buy a home?
And I'm 27. I think about that too.
That's right. And we're seeing the age of the first home, buying a first home, has gone up to about 40 years old. It's because it's too expensive. So we have to hold those bad actors accountable that are buying up housing stock and, jacking up the prices, whether it's of rent or to be able to buy a home, jacking up those prices. We've got to be able to hold them accountable. We need to make sure that housing can be built. There's a lot of red tape in Washington right now that is preventing housing from being built, and we need to do something to kind of reduce that and make that process more streamlined. We need to address redlining. Because when we think of some of the, you know, this is an administration that doesn't follow fair housing guidance and rules and regulations. And so the redlining that's been a real legacy of looking at communities, just like what I've seen here in the Metro East or in the South Side of Chicago or West Side of Chicago, where we know that Black communities could not buy in certain places. There's a legacy to that. And we need to do more to address that. And I will be a voice to address those issues. So yes, there's a lot more we need to do. Here in Illinois, we reinstituted the Smart Buy program, I think that's the name of it. And it allows first-time home buyers to get some credits for and some student loan forgiveness so that they can, so housing can be more affordable, because all of that ties in together. If you have high student loan debt and then you want to buy a house, it makes it almost impossible. We're helping people erase some of that debt so they can buy a house. And I see that at the federal level as being a model.
All right, let's talk about immigration. You have vowed that you would vote to abolish the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, known as ICE. Let's just say you get your wish. Like, would you want like other existing federal agencies to enforce immigration law? Would you want a completely new agency that is markedly different than the one that you have now? Like, specifically, what would come after abolishing ICE?
Well, what I don't want is a paramilitary force invading and occupying our American cities. And that's what this is. And when I say abolish ICE, under that umbrella is CBP as well.
Mm-hmm. The Border Patrol.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Who, by the way, are not on the border providing safer and more secure borders. They're in our American cities, primarily our Democratic-led cities. Mm-hmm. And this is terrorizing our communities, instilling fear. We've seen a VA nurse shot and killed in Minneapolis. We've seen a mom shot in the face. This is what cannot stand. And I want to abolish ICE because I don't see that as having the ability to be reformed. Mm-hmm. I don't. So we need to do something different. Now, we will look at other agencies, but I want everybody to remember, we didn't have ICE as its current form before 2003. Mm-hmm. So we've done something different. It doesn't mean I don't want secure borders. Of course I do. But that's not what this is.
Yeah, I think that like one of the things that hasn't been talked about a lot, especially in this current environment, is there are other alternatives to doing what is going on in Minneapolis and what went on in Chicago. Let's just say you hire lots of immigration judges and allow for asylum cases to be adjudicated more. Maybe you force businesses to do E-Verify, and that reduces the economic incentive to exploit undocumented workers. What do you think about both of those ideas? Because that, I think, and this is just my observation, those would probably be a much more effective way to disincentivize undocumented people to come to the United States than what's happening now. I'd be interested to hear what your opinion is on both of those things. More immigration judges and stricter scrutiny of businesses employing undocumented workers.
Well, first of all, let me say one of the things that I talk about is how, you know, in this conversation about immigration reform or comprehensive immigration reform, one of the things that I do talk about is needing to have greater investments in that system so that it can work. And remember, we had a real path to concrete immigration reform. Donald Trump came in and made calls to Republicans and blocked it. So there was an opportunity to really look at a solution. This president does not want a solution. What this president wants is chaos. What this president wants is fear. What this president wants is the ability to distract from his failures. And I've said it before and I'll say it again. He's a wannabe dictator who does not want to see fair and free elections. And all of this chaos and these threats are all examples of that. So we need to have a real pathway. We have hardworking people who have come to this country, who work and contribute to our communities, who are paying taxes and doing so much more. And there needs to be a pathway to citizenship. There needs to be a pathway for DACA recipients and Dreamers. There needs to be a process. Donald Trump blocked bipartisan legislation to get us there, and now is using fear and cruelty to terrorize our community. So this isn't it. This isn't it.
So we only have a couple minutes left. I think that Will wants to do a lightning round of Metro East related issues before we let you go back into the Metro East, which is a great part of Illinois.
I wanted to ask about the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act. I don't know if you're too familiar with it, but it was passed as part of the One Big Beautiful Bill, and it added 21 Missouri zip codes that gives community members who are sick due to radiation an opportunity to get paid for their ailments. Congresswoman Budzinski had wanted one zip code here on the Illinois side of the river that touches Venice and Madison, Granite City, to be included. It didn't. I'm curious, if you're elected to the Senate, would you push for that zip code, that zip code's inclusion?
Yes.
Why so?
Because look at what's happening. I mean, we have an administration that doesn't believe in science, and so much of these issues around environmental issues are environmental justice issues. You know, communities that have for far too often are harmed by practices, but then don't get any redress. And we have to do more to make sure that communities that have been harmed can get what they need to move forward. And I don't see that happening. I don't see that leadership coming out of Washington right now. And I would love to fight for that for the people who are impacted.
Along the same lines of environmental issues, I imagine you're probably familiar with Cokie Heights and all the sewer problems and flooding they've had. And I know the state has, through the Environmental Protection Agency, Illinois Environmental Protection Agency, has gotten grant programs to help fund some of the many needed repairs. But if you talk to the residents, they maybe see the headlines, or they understand that there is dirt moving, but the problem still persists. So I'm wondering, as a senator, what would you do to fix this longstanding program?
Well, I don't know if I have the specific steps, but what I can say is I've been to Cahokia Heights many times. I've talked with leadership there, the mayor and others, and I know the issue, and I know what we've done to try to bring some solutions that to a longstanding problem from the state level. As the next United States Senator, that will be something that's a priority. And I think what's most important is making sure that the voices of the people, that I take them, those voices with me to Washington. People often feel like when there's been long-term disinvestment or maybe an issue has not been addressed, of course, it cannot get resolved soon enough. It's been too long. And so this is something that I hope to bring some real leadership to. Again, through an environmental justice lens, they should not have to deal with those issues. They should have working, you know, sewers, they should have working utilities, and they should be able to live in where their housing has, you know, their values aren't impacted by this, the assessment of their homes. This is something that, again, is something that I would prioritize.
Last Metro East specific question I wanted to ask you about, which is the steel mill in Granite City, which they recently got some pretty good short-term news, which is they're starting one of the two blast furnaces back on. But I wanted to ask about the role that the Trump administration has played in U.S. Steel now with the new Japanese owner, and that is what's called the Golden Share, which gives the Trump administration, or the federal government rather, a seat on the board and also veto authority. And we've seen kind of similar deals with the chipmaker NVIDIA, a profit-sharing deal where the federal government has maybe inserted themselves in private business where they hadn't. So I'm just curious, more broadly speaking, what do you how do you feel about maybe those types of deals, the federal government and private business going in, well, in business together, if you will?
So there's a distinction between public-private partnerships, which is where the private sector and the public sector work together to solve challenges. I'm all for that, but that's not what this is. We are seeing this president who is motivated by, A, stroking his own ego, secondly, making himself and his wealthy friends wealthier. And we've seen how much, even since he's taken office, how much more he's brought, I don't know, $1.4 billion or more dollars that he has enriched himself. So that is not an example of what I think is a public-private partnership of solving problems and challenges together. And I think we need to be very clear on our motives as government, which is to do what's best for the people and not for ourselves as elected leaders.
Well, thank you so much, Madam Lieutenant Governor, for joining us today. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is part of the University of Missouri-St. Louis. And how could people find out more about your campaign on the internet, where you want to be found?
Well, thank you so much for having me, and I enjoyed having this conversation. Please, everyone, go to julianastratton.com to learn more about my policy positions and more about my campaign. And don't forget that Election Day is March 17th, and early voting starts in St. Clair County on February 5th.
Thank you very much, and until next time, so long. Politically Speaking is produced by Sarah Kellogg, Rachel Lipman, and me, Jason Rosenbaum. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts. From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.